This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhi. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Kenya's 2010 constitution encourages gender equality and suggests that no more than two-thirds of those appointed to elective or appointed bodies be of the same gender. But the number of women seeking elective office in Kenya still remains relatively low.
That's Ruben Chama reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also, a suspect has been arrested after planning to attack government infrastructures and buildings in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos. And political opposition leader Frank Diongo has been sentenced to 5 years in prison in the DRC.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Nigerian police say they have arrested a suspect in the attempted bombing of a busy bridge in Lagos, the commercial capital. Officials identified the suspect, Abiodun Amos, as an oil activist. He and several others named by Amos were planning attacks on other government infrastructures and buildings. Police say Amos' hideout contained boxes of explosives, assault weapons, and 125 detonators. The third mainland bridge is often crammed with traffic along its 12-kilometer span. Oil activists typically target oil facilities to demand more money from the proceeds. Militants and local leaders from Nigeria's Niger Delta argue that oil pollution has damaged traditional livelihoods of agriculture and fishing in Africa's second-largest oil-producing state.
A new initiative aimed at encouraging more women to run for political office is gaining momentum in Kenya as the East African nation gears up for 2017 polls. The effort, backed by U.S. aid and donors, will encourage up to 5,000 women to run for local, state, and national positions. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Kenya's 2010 constitution encourages gender equality and suggests that no more than two-thirds of those appointed to elective or appointed bodies be of the same gender. But the number of women seeking elective office in Kenya still remains relatively low. This is due to several factors, such as negative attitudes towards women among communities and lack of financial support. But activists hope to change the trend. They recently launched a new spirited campaign in Nairobi seeking to promote women into leadership positions and to recruit women as party candidates. Professor Jacqueline Oduor is a renowned gender expert.
Today we are here to launch the list of 5,000 women, and in particular to profile the women, to create awareness, to ensure that women do not remain in the dark, to ensure that we do not burden women, whether it is at the political party level or at the family level or any other level.
The initiative, dubbed the List of 5,000 Women Aspirants, spearheaded by the United States International Development Agency, USAID, and other donor agencies, aims at building the confidence of women vying for public office. That includes training that will enhance their ability to effectively compete in politics, which is dominated by men. United States Ambassador to Kenya Robert Godek says the new campaign will seek to empower women across the country to run for political positions.
Together with our partners, we're working to ensure that women aspirants in all 47 counties have the opportunity to launch effective campaigns in 2017 if they choose to do so. Now, why this program? The answer is really quite simple. Despite the progress that's been made, and there has been a lot of progress, Kenyan legislative bodies continue to fall short of the two-thirds gender threshold. And when you look closely at the last election, you see that out of the nearly 1,500 seats in county assemblies, only 80 women were directly elected. At the national level, only 16 women were directly elected for single-member constituency seats. None were elected to the Senate, and there is not a single woman governor.
According to Ms. Phoebe Asiyo, a former elected member of parliament and a prominent political leader among Kenyan women, women's law participation rate in politics can be attributed to many social, cultural, and political hurdles that they face today.
It was not easy, but I was determined. Violence was bad. You talk about violence these days. The vile language was terrible. The insults, the abuses, in the hope that you'll chicken out. Don't ever chicken out when they abuse you. You know, the worst thing they can do is to call you a loose woman. Yeah. That one they know you'll run away because, they know that once you are associated with women who are not clean, who are not honored, you just want to run away.
Margaret Kamar is a renowned university professor and politician. She urges women leaders to come up with new strategies to win in the forthcoming general elections.
You need to always interrogate your own self so that you are very clear why you want to go into leadership. Who do you want to lead as a women's leader? Are you going to lead women? Are you going to lead a constituency? Are you going to lead a ward? Where do you want to anchor yourself in your leadership? You need to ask yourself, am I strong enough to do the county? Am I strong enough to do the constituency? Measure yourself.
So far, the list has over 3,500 ethnic and age-diverse aspiring women candidates, including women with disability, at national and county levels, drawn from most political parties, but also including independent candidates. The project aims to persuade at least 1,500 to get involved. Samuela Lerno is an aspiring candidate member of County Assembly for Samburu County.
One thing that I really need to see is this being made, let it work. Because we have had so many commitments in this country. Our constitution is beautiful, voted the best in the country, with all the provisions for gender requirements and all that. But yet it's not being implemented. So now as we go to 2017, my hope, and I hope this is actually what I have had even in the grassroots, is that this is going to be made reliable. Because most of the time we see the political parties coming to the ground, if you won the elections but you are not the favorable face from the political party, they snatch the certificate away from you.
In the country's last general election in 2013, no single woman won a seat in the Senate or as a governor. Among the 290 elected members of parliament or MPs, only 5.5% are women. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Plains ally to Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar and the House of Representatives in eastern Libya have conducted airstrikes against a rival militia, the Benghazi Defense Brigade, in the town of Houn Djoufra. Houn is located 3 hours' drive to the west of oil fields currently controlled by Haftar's Libyan National Army. Speaking on Libyan TV this week, Haftar spokesman Ahmed Mismari said that the Libyan National Army was ready for an attack by the Benghazi Brigade. Mismari also said Haftar's forces soon expect an outside endorsement for their entry into Tripoli to protect civilians in the nation's capital, where the UN-backed government of national unity is struggling to achieve political control. Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Jason Pack, founder and president of Libya Analysis, about the airstrikes and the continued conflict in Libya.
Well, what's very interesting here is that since Haftar has controlled the oil crescent from September 11th of this year, he has further consolidated his control. Oil exports are up. The Libyan economy is benefiting from this. He has repulsed every counterattack. Now, with the fall of ISIS in Sirte, some of those groups who helped defeat ISIS are ready to go on and attack Haftar. But it doesn't seem like they'll get very far. There was a counterattack earlier in December, and it was crushed by the LNA and Haftar before it got anywhere. This counterattack seems similar, that it doesn't pose much of a chance of success, but it bodes ill for political tensions going forward.
So who is providing the Libyan National Army with air force?
Well, that's a good question. They have their own air force. It could easily be that they are helped by the Egyptians or even the Russians. But I would have to assume that these airstrikes on Jufra and Houn are, you know, flown by Libyans or at least flown in nominally Libyan planes.
Do you fear a new escalation in the Libyan conflict?
I'm worried about one. I have a degree of optimism that these things are just testing out the one side, testing the other. They know that they can't dominate the whole country and they will have to come to some kind of tense compromise. And maybe the new year will bring a new approach by the international community to sidestep the UN process or to approach things in a different way.
But with three competing governments and several supporting militias, what's the way out of the continued conflict in Libya?
I believe a grand bargain, which is not imposed from the top down, but built from the bottom up, could work. The problem with the UN process is it seeks to create a government, have it be approved, have a prime minister who then imposes positions and cabinet members on the country. A system that could work would be a compromise between the main militias, say Zintan and Misrata, which is kind of happening now, and then, although it looks difficult with these clashes going on, some kind of grand bargain between Haftar and the LNA and the Misratans and bringing in Tebu and Tuareg militias, and then from the bottom up, from those militias, build a compromise government, or at least build de facto areas of influence and a power-sharing agreement. We can keep our fingers crossed that this could be done in 2017.
But there is no threat of dividing Libya into three entities.
Well, Libya is already divided into two or more entities, so I'm not worried about that, because what works in Tobruk doesn't work in Tripoli, and the way things are governed in Misrata is not how they function in Zawiya. Every town raises its own revenue, essentially, and has its own smuggling networks and corruption networks. We don't have a Libyan state which is coherent. So I think we have to accept the reality on the ground and build towards a Libyan state from there, not trying to impose a government, a quote-unquote Libyan government, like the UN-backed General National Accord government, on all these different entities and localities. It won't work. It's incongruous.
That was Jason Pack, founder and president of Libya Analysis. He was speaking with reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi.
Two days of torrential rain in the Democratic Republic of Congo killed at least 50 people and left thousands more homeless. The Kalamu River in southwest DRC overflowed its banks in the downpour, tearing down homes and sweeping some of its victims downstream into Angola. The waters rose as much as 2 meters above its normal level and left up to a meter of mud in its wake. Officials fear they may find more bodies buried underneath the dirt and debris. The river flows through the DRC's only Atlantic port city of Boma, near the mouth of the River Congo.
Well, the DRC yesterday sentenced political opposition leader Frank Diongo to 5 years in prison. He was found guilty of detaining three soldiers during protests last week. Human rights lawyer George Kapayamba says the sentencing of Diongo puts at risk current multi-party talks on scheduling a crucial 2017 national election. Diongo is president of the Lumumba's Progressive Movement Party. The National Electoral Commission failed to hold an election last April, which would have identified a successor to President Joseph Kabila. Mr. Kabila, whose second term expired this month, is constitutionally barred from a third term. His rule has been extended for 1 year. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 19 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A suspect has been arrested planning to attack government infrastructures and buildings in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos. A new initiative is gaining momentum to encouraging more women to run for political office in Kenya. And political opposition leader Frank Diongo has been sentenced to 5 years in prison in the DRC. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
In South Africa, Eric Lobsa and his wife Geraldine Finn are respected as two of the finest jewelry designers and makers in the country. In their Tencel Jewelry Studio in Johannesburg, the artists handcraft one-of-a-kind rings, necklaces, bracelets, and much more. The innovative jewelers specialize in using semi-precious stones, diamonds, gold, silver, and platinum. Darren Taylor reports in the fourth part of a series on some of South Africa's master crafters.
Eric Lobsha saws a piece of metal he'll include in a piece of jewelry. He and Geraldine Fenn say they enjoy playing with jewelry, designing unique items as a form of art.
We get to design things that are a little bit different. We've got quite alternative customers, couples who are a little bit different, who want something that's bespoke, that's designed for them.
They don't work according to traditional jewelry formulas and patterns. They're always experimenting with valuable metals.
Precious stones as well, rubies, sapphires, small diamonds, black diamonds.
It's not drilling to my finger.
Lobsha drills a hole in a piece of silver, in which he'll later set a jewel. He recently made an anniversary ring using a tourmaline gemstone.
Let's call it a honey-coloured tourmaline, which is a very strange colour tourmaline. So I basically made it this very antique ring. So it was that tourmaline oval in the middle, with pearls going around the bottom, coral at the top, good pink coral.
Then he fashioned a ring for someone who was inspired by the Lord of the Rings movies. Fenn says it looked like a little tiara.
And it had some blue sapphires, different shapes, and a little pearl in it. And it was in white gold. It was very pretty.
Another tinsel ring has a black onyx base, studded with numerous bits of silver platinum.
When your kids are watching Antique Roadshow in 200 years' time, that's the piece that the guy's going to get excited about. You know, like...
Lobsha says buyers are usually surprised when they realize tinsel's jewelry is handmade.
You start from a raw material and you just start working it. You're rolling it through a plate, you know, you cut it by hand. You know, the one guy that I did the thing for is an engineer, and he was like, oh, so where do you get a laser cutter that can cut the small? And I'm like, it's not a laser cutter, it's sawn by hand with a saw blade. If it's worked by hand, you get a stronger, better product.
He and Fenn are disappointed that they usually don't know where the diamonds they use come from.
They have this Kimberley process that's supposed to track diamonds, make sure that they're not blood diamonds coming from places where they're not supposed to be and all of that. But actually, you can't really tell where the diamond has been mined that you're buying.
Fenn finds it sad that precious stones travel a complicated export network from wherever they're extracted. As an example, she points to a silver ring containing a turquoise tourmaline.
One of the biggest producers of tourmalines is Namibia, which is next to us. But when you go to Namibia, it's quite difficult to buy them. They end up mostly being cut in India or in Thailand.
Africa exports its precious minerals for foreign exchange.
So even though they might have been mined here or next door to us, places like Mozambique, Botswana, Namibia, South Africa are all very rich in these semi-precious stones, but they often get taken out of the country to get cut, and then they come back in. By the time we get them, they've been through so many hands, you don't necessarily know where they actually were mined.
Lobsha flattens platinum with a hammer. The tinsel partners do know for sure that the raw gold and platinum they use is from South Africa.
It looks like sand, you know, like a rough sand. They weigh it out, so you buy 10 grams, they pour the sand-ish type of thing into a little bowl, there's your 10 grams, pay me, thank you. You don't buy this finished product, you know, and then you take that and you might alloy it, so you might add other metals to it to make it into an 18-carat or a 9-carat or how many carats.
Fenn revels in reworking jewellery sourced from all over the world.
I love old bits and pieces that have been loved and worn before. So vintage things, old jewellery. I particularly love Victorian jewellery that's extremely sentimental, that's very heavily engraved, it's quite ornate.
She'll take pearls and emeralds from jewellery from the 1800s and set them in silver, for example, to make more modern rings and necklaces, or encrust a grandmother's white seashell cameo brooch in translucent crystal for a granddaughter's ring. For Fenn, jewellery had much more significance in the past than it does today.
Everything had a meaning. The stones had a meaning. Flowers that were engraved all had a meaning. So you kind of built up this interesting coded language of something that you were going to express to the person that you gave it to.
Yet, as she softens metal using the intense heat of a blowtorch, she knows that every piece of tinsel jewelry has meaning, a story behind it. Each item is rare, giving years of memories and importance to the people who wear them. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
A Malian prosecutor says the Islamic militant group Al-Murabitoun is behind the kidnapping of a French aid worker in Gao late last week. Sophie Petronin headed a charity for orphans and had lived in northern Mali for the past 20 years. She was last seen on Saturday. A witness says she was taken hostage by armed men in a pickup truck. Reuters news agency quotes prosecutor Boubacar Sidiku Samaki as saying, "The first indications show Petronin was certainly taken hostage by the terrorist group Al-Murabitoun." No one has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, but the group has conducted attacks this year in Mali's north. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and Ansar Dine are also active in the area.
The leaders of the Tajamuka social media protest say they will intensify their demands for reform in Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party and in the government of President Robert Mugabe. Spokesman Promise Kwananzi has told local newspapers next year is a watershed year in which the coalition of activists will scale up their campaign for the immediate resignation of the 92-year-old Mr. Mugabe. Kwananzi said protests will also address the failures of opposition parties to become effective political forces in the nation.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.